I went to an event that was held at Emerald Hill Library. See, libraries have a lot of important roles in the community, and one of them is public events. And there was a book talk. It was called, it was about a book called Who Needs the ABC? And it was, and the subtitle to that, Who Needs the ABC? Why Taking It for Granted is No Longer an Option. How digital disruption and political dysfunction threaten the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's existence. It's been written by Matthew Ricketson and Peter McMullins. Matthew Ricketson is actually Professor Matthew Ricketson, and he did a book talk around this book. And he now is the lead at the journalism department at Deakin, formerly at RMIT, and formerly a journalist himself. But anyway, I thought it was worthwhile listening to what he had to say, because their research actually brought up some interesting new information, and it also gives you trawls across the nature of our media landscape and what has caused certain of the levers to be pulled throughout the existence of the ABC, leading to this sort of disastrous LNP carry-on over the last almost 10 years that we've been experiencing. The last election really was a lucky escape, I'd have to say. So here we go. This is what he had to say.
Okay, our view is that the kind of Australia that we've been sketching in this little thought experiment would be a much lesser Australia than the one we have now. We believe that the ABC is one of this country's most important cultural institutions, producing an enormous amount of material, informative and entertaining, that contributes in a rich and vital way to this country's intellectual, cultural, social and political life. There are grounds to suggest that disregard is widely shared in Australia. The ABC reaches more Australians every day now than it did at any time in its history, runs more radio stations and television stations than it ever has, and its online reach through abc.net.au, but also through platforms such as YouTube, Facebook and Instagram, perhaps not yet TikTok, is significant. abc.net.au is the most popular news and current affairs website in Australia, and has been since just before the pandemic began. It's ahead of any others. That's news.com.au, smh.com.au, Guardian Australia, and so on. Nonetheless, such a world, that is one without an ABC, is arguably closer to hand than we might think, because over the past decade, the ABC has existed at a buffeted intersection of criticism. And that criticism has come from the commercial media, it's come from the political class, and it's come from ideologues, and it has been heated. What we'd like to show you today and through the book is how this has come about, because the hostility towards the ABC has been loud, relentless, and grinding. And it's all been very similar in intent: to build a picture of the ABC as a bloated and biased organisation that is running amok, that is somehow un-Australian, and that we would be better off without it. Darren Chester, who's a National Party MP and who was the Minister for Veterans Affairs under Tony Abbott and Malcolm Turnbull when they were Prime Minister, told us, and I quote, "Many of my colleagues in the government, coalition government, see the ABC as the enemy and think it should be treated as such." Now, the ABC is no stranger to criticism, and if you've actually looked at Ken Inglis's two volumes of history of the ABC, which go back to its formation in 1932, you'll find no shortage of controversies. But there has been a change in its tenor in the last decade or so, and to understand that, you need, we think, to understand 3 points. And the first is the change in the media landscape in this country, the whole media landscape. If you go back to the 1990s, when the internet was just arriving in this country in the early 1990s, the commercial media was in its pomp and the ABC was in its box. The media sector was print, radio and television, and it was highly profitable for all concerned. classified ads in the then Fairfax newspapers, for example, what you'd read to buy a car or find a job or look for a house, were the rivers of gold, as Rupert Murdoch has called them, and advertisement space elsewhere was also high-priced on commercial television. The Sydney Morning Herald and The Age newspapers made about $1 million in profit each week, primarily on the back of their weekend edition. Broadcasters like Alan Jones and John Laws were paid more than $3 million a year. And television stations made money hand over fist. There were also more than 3,000 magazines in this country, 37 regional daily newspapers, 250 suburban newspapers. The Australian Women's Weekly sold more than 1 million copies per issue. The ABC, by contrast, at that time, confined its operations to radio and television only, and its programs rated solidly but constantly behind commercial competitors. It had divisions for its music, its drama, its performing arts, including, until 1996, symphony orchestras, and in-house facilities that enabled it to create dramas, comedies, documentaries, and more on TV and radio. It ran good quality news and current affairs programs and had a laudable record of investigative journalism, particularly on Four Corners, which began in the early 1960s. But generally at that time, the ABC was not an agenda-setting news organisation. It followed the lead, or the news leads, I should say, of the commercial media providers. So at that time, the ABC was safe, was reliable, predictable, and a little fussy, hence the nickname Artie. The asteroid that altered this was the internet. And initially, in the early 2000s, news media companies made their content available for free online in the belief that this would grow their audiences and thereby increase their attractiveness for advertisers. Now, from today's perspective, that looks inexplicably dumb. But it's worth understanding that the news business, especially newspapers, had always been a hybrid business, that is, where profits from the cover price amount constituted only a proportion and probably a minority proportion of the total amount of revenue that the companies were bringing in from their newspapers and magazines. The rest of it, the bulk of it, came from advertising revenue. The internet, however, blew up that model, enabling creation of standalone advertising websites to meet customers' individual needs. By the mid-2000s, if you wanted to hunt for a house or a car or a job, you could do that for free. You didn't have to buy the newspaper each weekend and wade through hundreds, literally hundreds of pages of newsprint. They were 250 pages at their biggest back then. I don't know if you remember it. But you could narrow your search. You could quickly turn up precise information. And if you were selling, meanwhile, you posted an ad to these sites for next to nothing. The new online classified advertising sites could undercut the commercial media providers' rates because they were in that business only and had none or few of the costs associated with gathering and distributing news. Because to gather and distribute news, you need journalists, and they're costly. It's one of the reasons in the last book that I worked on with a colleague at Melbourne Uni, Andrew Dodd, lots and lots of journalists were laid off from about 2012. Thousands of them. So that's another story, of course, and what effect that's had on the media is another story, but it's related. So one half of the hybrid business model of commercial media providers collapsed. In between 2012, advertising online went from 25% of the market to 53% of the market, and it's continued to grow. And the bulk of the money that was earned from that advertising went to Google and Facebook. So media companies reacted to this cataclysmic change in various ways. One of them I've already alluded to is that they started laying off a lot of journalists and printers and advertising people and other people who worked for them. They sought to close the door on the barn, however, by putting their content behind paywalls, hoping that people would pay for the news that for the past decade had been available online for free. Didn't work. Didn't, as you can imagine, you give something away for free and then you start asking people to pay for it. it's like putting your foot on the accelerator and the brake at the same time. It kind of just doesn't really work very well. Also, they changed the kind of news that they were producing. In a phrase, a lot more opinion and a lot more simple breaking news. So Sean Kelly, who writes a column in The Age in the Sydney Morning Herald, he used to be an advisor to the two former Labor Prime Ministers, Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd. He said this some years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, news has always been a business. There's no point pretending otherwise. And what do you do if you need to create more content with less money? You create cheap content. And what are the cheapest types of content to produce? Opinions and breaking news. The beauty of opinions is that everyone's got one. The beauty of breaking news is that it doesn't have to be that important or even difficult to get. It just has to have happened in the recent past. So suddenly you've got news and opinions and breaking news everywhere. Alongside policies around syndication, this is arguably why certain commentators have become more influential in the past decade and why arguments about the bias of media companies have become more pronounced. They've always been there, but there's no doubt that the kind of concerns about them have increased in recent years. There is an arguable self-interest when you're trying to get people to open their wallet to position your organisation as being on a certain side, appealing to a certain demographic, at the very least making it very clear where you stand on the issues of the day. Now, the scope and the ambit of these attempts to make a model are up for debate, but there can be no denying that the internet laid waste to the model existing until then. And this was before COVID, which saw the closure of more than 100 regional and local newspapers, building on the 100 that had been shut down between 2008 and 2018. And what this meant was that by 2021, there were 19 news deserts in Australia, that is, 19 local government areas that had no local media coverage. The problems that affected the commercial news media industry, however, did not affect the ABC in the same way, because it's government funded and doesn't take advertising. It didn't have to contend with the same business model problems. Moreover, the ABC adapted to the internet's rise. It began putting material online in the 1990s, began reporting news online, created multimedia packages around newsworthy events. In 2010, it launched ABC 24, which provides around-the-clock news coverage. Radio National, well, people at Radio National embraced podcasting in 2008. The ABC launched iView, as I mentioned earlier, years ahead of the commercial networks. The ABC reshaped itself, shutting down its in-house production facilities in favour of contracting independent producers, corporatising its symphony orchestras, and investing more resources in its news and current affairs division, particularly in investigative journalism. This change in the media landscape has had a few effects. First, commercial media providers trying to find a new business model have become increasingly agitated by the ABC. They've never been particularly happy about it, but these news providers have been saying, how are we supposed to get people to open their wallets and subscribe to our content when the ABC is giving away this news and content for free? It's not an unreasonable question. Second, the commercial media providers have become louder in their dislike of their obligations, particularly in rural areas. So the Nine Entertainment Company's chief executive, Hugh Marks, or he was the chief exec a few years ago, declared that his duty primarily was to his shareholders, and that in the absence of the ability for his company to make significant profits from broadcasts in rural and regional Australia, he believed that his company shouldn't have to do so. The ABC can do that, he said. And you might argue that's fine, except that when 9 and 7 and 10 got their commercial television licences, they got them because that was there was a bidding process and they were provided with scarce spectrum, highly profitable, so that came with various obligations on them to produce local content, to produce a certain amount of news and so on. And here was the chief executive of Nine basically saying, we can't make money anymore, therefore just you know, junkyard sale, really. Give it away to the ABC. So some of the issues that the commercial media has been grappling with have been improved. The federal government, that is the last federal government, created the News Media Bargaining Code, under which the global tech giants Google and Facebook would be forced to negotiate with those news media companies for the use of their journalism. The deals that have been struck under this code have seen substantial funds go to news media companies, that is, News Corporation, owned by Rupert Murdoch and his family, Nine Entertainment Company, Kerry Stokes' Seven, West Media, and so on. Somewhere in the vicinity of about $200 million a year at present, some people even estimate up to 300, but let's say 200 million for 3 years. But the antagonism towards the ABC arising from a commercial self-interest has remained, however. Home to much of that antagonism has in fact been News Corporation Australia, the dominant media company in this country.
3CR Community Radio, giving voice to the community since 1976.
And you're with Annie on 3CR Breakfast, Solidarity Breakfast. And we're in the middle of listening to a speech given by Matthew Ricketson. He is a co-author of Who Needs the ABC? Now, what he's just been talking about is a sort of summing up of probably known facts. If you've been following the media, you will know a whole range of things that he's been talking about, but it's quite nice to get the actual figures. The next part is the political perspective on the ABC. Just a private word, a personal word, that History of the ABC by Ken Inglis, it's the only book that I have underlined in pen. That is a confession. The most boring book I think I've ever read. And I have read it. There you go.
This antagonism from the commercial media towards the ABC has joined with the change in the political landscape. It's generally said that all governments dislike the ABC, and it's possible to see why this might be so. The ABC depends on the government for its funding, but because of its charter obligations, it is required to provide an independent broadcasting service that reports without fear or favour, independent and impartially on the government of the day. The tension then between a government that might not like what the ABC is reporting, yet funds the ABC to do that reporting, is unavoidable. The research that we did for the book suggests that this idea that all governments dislike the ABC is a half-truth. While all governments dislike the ABC, some dislike it more than others. And this becomes apparent when you compare the treatment of the ABC under governments over a sustained period. We decided to have a look back to when the ABC went from being a commission to a corporation back in 1983 when the Hawke Labor government came to power. And if you look at the funding under the four periods of government, or main periods of government, the Hawke-Keating Labor government between 1983 and 1996, and then the Howard coalition government between 1996 and 2007, followed by the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd Labor governments between 2007 and 2013, and then finally, most recently, the Abbott-Turnbull-Morrison coalition governments, 2013 to this year. That's almost 50-50, you know, it's about 19 and a half years for the coalition and about 19 years for Labor. So it's actually kind of quite useful period to see. What you see if you looked at about page, I think it's 186 in the book, is if you graph the funding for the ABC from those various governments, it goes up under Hawke Keating, down under Howard, up under Rudd-Gillard-Rudd, and down under Abbott-Turnbull-Morrison. And it is literally that stark. It's like a cross-cut saw, okay? And Patrick did a bit of extra work and went back to the McMahon period. The cross-cut saw, you know, is already there in place. So this is a kind of... It's something that most people don't want to talk about. The The coalition governments don't want to talk about it because they don't want to look bad in the eyes of people who support the ABC. The Labor governments, and even when they're in opposition, don't really want to talk about it because they don't want to look like they favour the ABC. The ABC doesn't want to talk about it because it has to be like Caesar's wife on the question of its funder, the federal government. So they kind of, they run a line which is, we're just here doing our job, we will report without fear or favour. If that annoys the coalition government or Labor government, so be it, that's our job. And so they don't want to draw attention to this either. And most of the rest of the media doesn't want to draw attention to it either, because either because they're brawling with the ABC on ideological or commercial grounds, or in question mark, I don't know why, but it, the information that we gathered for the book and in this context, and I must acknowledge the work of another colleague, Michael Ward, who's a PhD candidate at the University of Sydney and a former ABC executive himself. He did the deep dive into the ABC's budgets, and I can give you 10 minutes on the ABC's budget, but you probably will start groaning. Suffice to say, it's labyrinthine, it's complicated. He sifted and sorted his way through it in order to come up with this chart. So I had a kind of inkling that this might be the case, but I'd never seen it proven one way or the other. And if it wasn't the case, so be it. That's, you know, let the chips fall where they lie. When he actually did the deep dive and found that out, he said he was quite surprised by how much of a cross-cut saw it was. This is someone who's both worked at the ABC and has been studying it for his thesis. I'll finish with this aspect of it. The funding is one part of the picture. The other is the way the governments talk about and treat the ABC. And again, there is enough of a record over that sort of period from 1983 to now to show a clear disparity. There's certainly been moments of tension and antipathy between the ABC and the Hawke and Keating governments, but they were generally driven by the ABC's reportage. The ABC broadcast a Four Corners programming alleging corruption in New South Wales under the then Premier Neville Wran shortly after Labor came to office in 1983, and there were suggestions of retribution. Paul Keating made some pretty colourful remarks to the then ABC managing director David Hill, and indeed when Four Corners reported on the activities of businessman and Hawke confidant Peter Abels, Hawke said publicly, "We don't fund the ABC to do stories on Peter Abels." Do you remember Peter Abels? There were suggestions at one point that the ABC's independence should be quashed, and there was a furore over the ABC's use of commentator Robert Springborg during the first Gulf War back in 1990-91. And yet, these moments appear not to have otherwise tarred the relationship. And the Hawke and Keating governments not only presided over funding increases to the ABC, that talk of quashing the ABC's independence were themselves quashed by the Minister for Communications at the time, Michael Duffy, and any suggestion of retribution was never actually dealt out, as far as we can tell. And one of our primary sources for that is Ken Inglis's History of the ABC. Michael Duffy actually said later that Hawke's antagonism towards the ABC, and I quote, "always stopped short of punishment." And there's no suggestion that Keating's threat to Hill ever transpired. Triennial funding, in fact, was introduced under the Hawke-Keating government, and ABC board appointees included two former Liberal MPs in Neville Bonner and Ian McPhee. Under the Howard government, matters were different. John Howard himself was fond of certain aspects of the ABC. He was apt to appear in its commentator box at the cricket, and he told ABC chair Donald McDonald that he would never speak to him about the ABC, never raise it with him as an issue. Indeed, if McDonald wished to speak to him about the ABC, then he should make an appointment through Howard's office to do it. However, Howard was also fond of one of his advisers' claims that the ABC was, quote, "our enemy talking to our friends," and was critical of aspects of the ABC's coverage. His communications minister, Richard Alston, was hostile towards the broadcaster, presiding over a significant funding cut in the Howard government's first budget after promising that there would be no cut, and introducing tied funding, that is money that has to be used for a specific purpose. The Howard government pointed a raft of avowed ABC critics to the ABC board, including Michael Kroger, Ron Brunton, Keith Windschuttle and Janet Albrightson. Alston also made continuous use of the complaints process to make complaints about ABC coverage. During the second Iraq War in 2003, he made 68 complaints about reportage on the ABC. The complaints were scrutinised and only two were found to have merit. He was unhappy and appealed to an independent board, which found merit in 17 of the 68 complaints, but no more. Still unhappy, Alston took his complaints to the then broadcasting regulator, the Australian Broadcasting Authority, which upheld 21 of the 68. Despite the fact that less than a third of his complaints were upheld, Alston claimed to be vindicated. Under the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd governments, there appear to have been very few moments of tension or criticism. The Labor Party had, since 2002, made it policy to set up a formal independent process for appointments to the ABC board, which they enacted in 2011. And in addition to its budgeted funding increases, the government provided funding to switch from analogue to digital transmission, offered extra money for the creation of a dedicated children's channel, offered in 2013 dedicated funding for enhanced news gathering and investigative journalism, and saw the ABC expand its digital and online footprint. The murkiest episode during this period concerned the award of a contract for the Australia Network, which broadcast television into the Asia-Pacific region. But there were few to no moments of tension of the kind that we've already mentioned. But under the Abbott-Turnbull-Morrison governments, the ABC has fared much worse. Tony Abbott, reprising Richard Alston, promised the night before the 2013 election there would be no cuts to the ABC, and broke that promise famously in his first budget. The $996 million contract to fund the Australian network was cancelled, and cuts were successfully delivered to the ABC's budget in 2014, 15 and 16. Indexation of ABC funding was paused, cutting its funding. The enhanced news gathering program was renewed but also cut by a third. And the ABC's allegiances were criticised. Abbott said in 2014, "I think it dismays Australians when the national broadcaster appears to take everyone's side but our own." "Whose side are you on?" he asked in 2015. Matters hardly altered under Malcolm Turnbull, the darling of the Q&A set at that time, as you may remember. The formal process for appointments to the ABC board was flouted, even disregarded, and complaints about the work of journalists Emma Alberici and Andrew Proben ran through official channels as well as unofficial private remonstrations and pressure. This became central to the 2018 fracas that saw the managing director Michelle Guthrie sacked by the ABC board and the chairman Justin Milne depart a few days later in what is still one of the most, if not the most, tumultuous weeks in the ABC's history. With claims that Milne had urged Guthrie to sack Alberici and Proben in response to the government's complaints. More recently, under Scott Morrison, the appointments process continued to be flouted. The current chair, Ida Buttrose, was actually appointed without any formal process. Funding continued to decline and ministers dissembled about whether funding was rising or falling. Moreover, under Morrison, the ABC became an even more frequent target of criticism, particularly over ABC coverage and reportage. The relationship became extremely fraught, and there were announcements of Senate inquiries and hearings into the ABC and its duties, and public lectures from the Prime Minister then about what was appropriate or not. And that brings us to the election in May, which obviously saw a change of government, and I'm sure that a lot of people around the country breathed a sigh of relief and thought, well, that must mean everything is going to be hunky-dory now for the ABC. And I, at one level, that there's some truth in that, as in immediately the incoming Labor government promised to meet one of the ABC's requests, which was to change the period of funding from 3 years to 5 years. And the reason for that is that a three-year funding period, triennial funding as it's called, kind of falls within the electoral cycle and is so prey to the electoral cycle. 5 years takes you outside of that and hopefully depoliticises it a bit. They've also promised, the new Communications Minister Michelle Rowland has promised to make sure that the appointments process for board directors is adhered to rather than flouted. Beyond that, not much yet. Now, obviously, the government has a few things on its mind right now. You'd have to acknowledge that. But there are, I think the main message before I sit down and take questions is if we think that the ABC's everything's fine now, I think that would be mistaken. And I think if we only think about it come election day, then that's a mistake too, because there's things to do with the way in which the ABC is run and its processes which do need improvement. I mean, for example, this hasn't been much written about, but if you think that sustained cuts over the best part of a decade have not had any impact on the ABC's performance, I think you'd be mistaken.